You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. Today I had the chance to talk to Rudy Rickner, Neil Rickner, who is in fact the same person. We didn't get a chance to talk to it in the show as I originally said in my next intro, but he was a fighter pilot, which is where the name Rudy came from. Oddly, a small bit of history for you here, or a small insight into the different world that is fighter pilots. Nobody gets call signs like Iceman or Maverick in the military. If they have a call sign like that, it's because they had an extraordinarily silly call sign when they were young officers. And when they became older officers and able to move back to a squadron and have command later on in their lives, they picked a call sign that sounded cooler. Basically, everybody starts out with a call sign like Duck or Crazy Man or something like that. So anyways, Neil's call sign was Rudy. More important than his call sign, more important than what he did in the military, which he'll talk a little bit about, is that he is a man of seemingly internal contradictions. On the one side, just like myself, he spends a lot of his time doing things for the reserves, spent a long time on active duty. And on the other side, he too is trying to make the world a better place, trying to make something rather than just destroy it before he dies. And he's trying to do that in a different part of Alphabet from me, a place called X, which is something like AT&T's old Bell Labs was. It's our division that just takes wild-eyed ideas and sees if they can bring them forward into reality. It's a real inspiration to talk to him, in part because you can almost feel his heart as he talks about struggling to try to bridge the gap between the culture that we have inside of Google and in Silicon Valley and the culture that some of his family has in Indiana and some of his own upbringing in Southern California. It's just a real pleasure to talk to him. More than that, I must admit, it's a pleasure for me to talk to him because I feel like in just about every respect, he has done everything that I have done and just cranked it up one level. And it's amazing to see what he's been able to do, what he's been able to accomplish. And it's just a real pleasure for me to talk to him. I hope that you enjoy listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. This morning, I have the pleasure of talking to Neil Rickner. Rudy Rickner is his alter ego because he was once a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps and is now heading up operations at X for us. Look, this is one of the conversations that I think I've looked forward to the most because you've probably done everything that I have done except at like a higher level than I have. Like, I think it's difficult to have one kid, you have two. I think it's difficult to be a captain, you're a major. I think it's difficult to work at Google, you work at Alphabet X, right? So personally, this conversation is something I've been looking forward to because I'm trying to figure out how do I balance things. And I know it's something that everybody struggles with, but I just want to thank you for taking the time this morning because I think your latest kid is 3 weeks old, 2 weeks old.
Yeah, 3 weeks today. That's right.
Three weeks old, and he's somehow found enough time and found enough credibility with his wife to be able to come out and have this conversation right now. So, look, I just want to thank you for coming on. Could you, in your own words, perhaps give a bit of an intro about your background and maybe start from where you grew up in America and on for the last 15 years or so?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. And you're right, my wife is a hero. So we'll start with that. She's given me the space and the opportunity to do a lot of things. And this is one of them. And I'm truly appreciative of that. So yeah, I grew up in Southern California. I was, you know, upper middle class kid, went to a great high school, had a great neighborhood, a lot of opportunities afforded to me. And, you know, as a kid who grew up on the beach, it doesn't make a lot of sense to folks, but I actually chose to go to college, undergraduate university at the University of Arkansas across the country. I was sort of curious about new places and things. And I was particularly interested in question of different points of view and how they impact on people's lives. And that's certainly become more relevant recently. So my mom's from Texas, and I had some, you know, family ties to the South, but generally speaking, knew nobody from Arkansas. Really, as I was searching for a place to go to school, it became a destination that I picked for myself. And as a young 18-year-old, mine was intrigued to go explore. And I was sort of in high school. I was a cadet. I was sort of in a program like JRTC. It's called Civil Air Patrol. So always interested in airplanes. And you know, when I was in junior high school, actually, to back up a little bit, I made a trip to D.C., Washington, D.C., on one of those junior high school trips. And on that trip, like most people do, I went to a bunch of museums and came across sort of a common theme that was summarized in a quote that was something around evil people will do evil things unless good people stand up against them. And in those museums,
I think the quote is all that's necessary for evil to succeed in the world is for good men to do nothing. I love that one. Well, great. Well pulled. I think I quoted that before I joined the Marine Corps too.
Awesome. Well, thank you for, I should probably know that. I remember the spirit of the quote, obviously, but thank you for pointing out the detail of it. So that stuck with me, and it motivated me to be part of the national defense. It motivated me to be a protector, if you will. And so I was always interested in airplanes. As I said, I was a cadet in Civil Air Patrol. I sort of put those couple of things together and decided that I wanted to be a Marine and be a Marine aviator. So when I went to Arkansas, I sort of had that in mind, and I was really focused on getting through school as quickly as I could. So I graduated in 4 years. I got commissioned the day after I graduated from college, and then went off to the basic school, which is, as you know, the Marine Corps' school that everybody goes to, where you get a little taste of everything the Marine Corps does, from logistics to administration to aviation to infantry. 6 months of that, and then down to Pensacola, Florida for flight school. I went through flight school in Pensacola and Meridian, Mississippi, Kingsville, Texas. And then just out of, you know, luck and timing and just, you know, the grace of God, and got assigned to San Diego to fly F-18s. So San Diego is only about 70 miles south of where I grew up in Southern California. And, you know, at that point, I pretty much felt like I was living the dream. And I was, in all honesty. It was flying my dream airplane close to home, you know, back on the beach. By that time, I was sort of kind of ready to get back to the West Coast and get back to the beaches. And I was in the squadron for, you know, 8 months when 9/11 happened. We all thought we were going to go to Afghanistan. Most of the military thought they were going to be sent to Afghanistan. As it happened, I was sent to fly AirCap over Guam, which was not the most exciting thing to do. You know, we were flying AirCap over all the major U.S. cities and some places overseas. And that trip turned out to be pretty outstanding. We did a bunch of great stuff, none of it related to, you know, the war that was going on Asia, South Asia, or anywhere in the Middle East. But we did get to land in a bunch of good islands and a bunch of old Marine battle sites. So like Tarawa and Peleliu and Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, we got to land at all those places. I was a part of that tour. I got back from that deployment, then deployed to Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom. That was in 2003. So I was part of that original Shock and Awe campaign, flying missions out of Kuwait, initial missions into Baghdad, but then flying close air support missions, you know, as the Marines advanced forward from Kuwait into places north. I did a couple of tours in Japan, and then ended up with doing a FAC tour. So a FAC tour is a forward air controller tour. So I spent a year out of the cockpit with the infantry. I was in a town called Ramadi, Iraq, where my job was to call in air support for Marines that were in a firefight and wanted to end that firefight. And then, you know, one more deployment, again in the air to Iraq. And then I got out in 2009. I came off of active duty. I went to business school and to the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia. So it's a dual master's degree. Graduated in 2012. And I was, you know, focused on trying to make the world a better place. That was quite literally all I knew I wanted to do when I went to graduate school. And I kept looking for places to do that. Sort of a long story, roundabout story for how I ended up at Google. But, you know, bottom line is I was kind of convinced I was going to go into the public sector. But, you know, I did a fellowship with Senator Feinstein on the Hill. And I did some exploration about what I might do in the public sector, and just wasn't really satisfied with anything that came out of that exploration. But when I came across tech, I was really motivated by it and really excited to see what could be done in the tech space. It was 2011, and This was just a few years after the iPhone was released. The lessons from my degree at SIPA, School of International Public Affairs, were essentially that international development is a really problematic space. A lot of what we do in international development isn't particularly effective. So you can teach somebody, or you can give somebody a fish and everybody knows that's bad. You can teach somebody to fish and people think that's better, and it is. But the reality is that if somebody wants to learn how to fish, they're probably going to seek out that information for themselves and teach themselves, or at least seek the resources to learn it themselves. And so I came across the idea that Google's mission was to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And then compared to the other companies that I was contemplating at the time, which were really about maximizing shareholder wealth, which is pretty much the mission statement of all the banks and the consultancies that I was considering at the time, Google was a really, really attractive option. And, you know, tech in general was pretty fascinating to me. So I kind of set my sights on Google and eventually ended up working at a role within Google Inc., which is sort of big Google, or, you know, the ads side of the house. But within about a year, I moved on to a startup within Google, also within Google Inc., and focused primarily on organizing information of a different sort, not the search kind of stuff that everybody's familiar with, but a startup-ish thing that was about trying to connect people over live video. And then, you know, a few years into that, I got a call saying that there was a role open that I was a good fit for on Makani in a project within Google X. And, you know, Makani is a next generation wind turbine. It looks like an airplane. It's technically a kite because it's tethered to the ground, but it goes up to access higher altitude winds, which are, I think, sort of intuitively people know that higher winds are more powerful and more consistent. And so the mission of Makani is to see if this kite can be a more cost-effective wind turbine. So everybody's familiar with those three-bladed wind turbines that sit on the top of a big, tall tower. Makani is trying to build an energy kite, which is tethered to the ground and produces more power for less cost. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do today. I mean, I've been in a couple of different roles here, and I currently lead strategy and operations for them.
Man, I think, have you seen the Dos Equis commercials in America?
Yes.
In other words, like, oh, the most interesting man in the world. He walks in and starts off as a fighter pilot, straight living the Tom Cruise dream, and then moves off to one of the most interesting parts of one of the most interesting companies in the world. There's so much in there. It's difficult for me to find a single thing to pull a thread on. But I think this theme about wanting to make the world a better place, it's perfectly in line with what I'm trying to dig into for this podcast. Out of all of that arc, all the way from Civil Air Patrol to the Marine Corps to working at X, is there a single thing that you would say is your personal mission statement? Or is it that you actually feel like, well, I'm happy to contribute in this area and in this area? And I think one thing you left out of your bio is that you're still in the reserves and you haven't fully given up the public service side of things, or the conventional public service side of things as well. Like, is there a single thing that you feel like this is the way in which I'm making the world a better place, or is it just more complicated than that?
Yeah, it's more complicated than that. Sometimes I question that approach, actually. I feel like I see some people that are just sort of laser focused on a way that they think that they can make a difference, and they're sort of relentless in the pursuit of that one thing. My approach has just been different, and you know, I try to balance between sort of more local opportunities. So when I moved here, you know, when you leave the Marine Corps or military service in general, I think most folks feel that they're left with a void, because the military is so many things to people, that it's your sort of friend base, it's your professional satisfaction, it's your community service, it's generally speaking your physical fitness. And when you leave the military, you sort of have to find those things in other places. So, I mean, I'll answer your question by saying that I've tried to build a bunch of different things that scratch different itches for me. So one, I'm, you know, a father, and I think my first mission has to be to raise two honorable sons that become upstanding young men and men. You know, I've also tried to impact my community by becoming a big brother. I try to do some things on a sort of more national level in terms of, you know, because I've had some exposure to the conflicts overseas and other cultures and international struggle, taken a special interest in the refugee problem. And I try to lend a hand on that front. Just because I have some experience going through it, veterans transitioning out of the military, that's not an easy thing to do. You know that as well as I do. And so I spend a fair bit of my time just trying to help vets who are coming out of the military make a good transition. You know, that is, it's hard to do gracefully, say that. A lot of people stumble. I stumbled a couple of times for sure. You know, but I can't let go either of this sort of macro, you know, political discourse things that I know you've talked some about, the, you know, the divided nature of our political discourse and all of that. So I would say I'm fragmented and probably too fragmented. And yet I can't bring myself to put any of it down. I try to just be impactful across all of them to the best way I'm capable.
So I can so relate to just about everything there. I just bought a paper tube manufacturing company to employ both veterans and refugees here in Australia as a side project. I do my best to try and contribute to the community at church, and I spend woefully little time, what feels like woefully little time, with my daughter and everything. I completely understand being pulled in a million different directions. I guess, how do you prevent yourself from becoming a dilettante? Or there's a pejorative sense in which you try and do everything and you do nothing well. How do you personally, most of the time, I'll open the kimono a bit, but most of the time for me, I feel like I'm trying to do everything and I'm doing about everything at, say, 90% of what I could be doing it at. I'm not sure that incremental 10% really adds a ton of value, but it's something I struggle with. Like, how do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile those competing missions?
Well, I think that every once in a while, I'm reminded that I think that what you just said is right, that I may not be getting to 100% effectiveness. I don't think I get to 90% even, but that what I do is impactful and is appreciated. So it's every once in a while, somebody will pull me aside and say, hey, this is really meaningful to me, or this was really helpful. Thank you so much. And so I guess you're framing this as, you know, how do you balance it all? And my answer, I guess, is kind of, I don't. I kind of just juggle it and do the best across these different things that I can, and feel all the time what you just expressed, which is that I'm failing at all of them. I try to do everything and basically feel like I'm failing at all of them. But then I remind myself every once in a while when somebody expresses thanks that, you know, maybe I'm not quite as ineffective as I'm being. So it's sort of a mental gymnastics in a way, but I also acknowledge that I'm harder on myself. And I think you probably relate to this too. You're probably your harshest critic, right? You're doing a lot, you're doing more than most. And I think, you know, the key here is that I'm willing to throw my hat in the ring and try and to be made a fool of if I don't do something quite well enough. And that's happened several times, right? I do screw things up, and yet I keep throwing my hat in the ring and keep trying because I'm just unwilling to let some of these things go.
I so relate to that. And it might not sound like a thoroughgoing Marine thing, but it is so quintessentially, for those of you who haven't spent much time around Marines, it's just like, well, you know, I have no idea how to do this mission, but I'm just going to keep throwing it in there and see, you know, I might come out a little bit bloodied. I might come out a little bit messed up, but I'm just going to keep throwing it in there because there's that old Theodore Roosevelt quote about the man in the ring, you know, it's not the critic who counts, right? It's the guy who, through his own big exertions, now you're seeing me butcher quotes. Anyways, I'll add that one to the show notes at the end of the day because that one's much longer. So one thing I'm curious to see how you deal with is you're fundamentally, this is something I internally struggle with. So tomorrow I take off on a flight to go do my reserve time. And it's something that I feel like, especially down here in Australia with Googlers out here, the people don't relate to well. Like, fundamentally, my understanding of what we do in the military is we train to, and we actually do, when called to, kill people and break things in the name of protecting a bigger corpus of knowledge and infrastructure and society and institutions. But we are fundamentally a destructive force. Like, that is at its base what the military is designed to be. Whereas there's clearly this motivation inside of you, and it's something that I can come totally resonate with. And I think a huge number of people in the nonprofit community would resonate with, where it's about trying to make the world a better place, trying to build, trying to create. And you're living in this kind of bimodal world where on one side you're holding on to the ability to rain fire down from heaven and destroy just about anything, and trying to come up with a next generation wind turbine that is going to ensure that we don't, you know, depend on coal or any other mix of fossil fuels and have point generation distribution systems all over the US. I wanted to bring you back to what you said about going to Arkansas with all that as framing. How do you navigate those conversations between those different people that you work with? Like, do you just come out and speak to them? I assume that you don't speak to people inside of X the same way that you would speak to people inside of the Marine Corps or vice versa. How do you try and merge those worlds personally for yourself? And like, what is effective for you there? Can you just tell me about that a little bit? I'm curious.
Yeah, it is. It's jarring. I'll say that. And, you know, we haven't spoken recently, but I'm actually getting ready to retire. So I'm still a reservist, but I'm just a few months away from actually hanging up the spurs after, you know, 20 years. So 12 years active and 8 years in the reserves. So I'm nearing the end of that journey. But I've, you know, the last 8 years have been really, really interesting in the ways you just described that. You know, I came out of the military feeling very uncomfortable in a civilian setting. I didn't know sort of how to speak to people because I had been speaking Marine for a long time. And I think a stark contrast to that now is that when I go back to the Reserve Center now, I have to take a few minutes to remind myself of how to speak in that environment. So it's a different language. It's also a different set of even just how you raise your voice or when you raise your voice or how directly you speak. I think it's especially exacerbated in San Francisco and at a place like Google, where we are a bunch that is fairly polite to each other. And I mean, just in one dimension of politeness, you know, the Marine Corps doesn't value that in the same way. The Marine Corps, for a lot of reasons that may be obvious, just direct communication is warranted and expected in many cases. And so, you know, the example of that is, you know, if you want to get somebody's attention in the Marine Corps setting, not all the time, but you know, a gunnery sergeant's going to raise his voice and bark orders at the sergeant and the lower ranking enlisted men and women. And if you raised your voice at Google, it would be it would be at least somewhat offensive to have anybody raise a voice to get their point across here in the conversations we have. It's just, so I start with that to say that there are some pretty dramatic contrasts in communication style and certainly those expectations of, you know, behavior. But there's far more common ground than uncommon. You know, it's the things that have made me successful here at Google and at X and Makani are the things that were bred into us in the Marine Corps. Do what you say you're going to do. Think strategically and treat your team with respect. Get to know your team. Think about things methodically. The list is much longer than we could talk about during this session. There's so much in that the Marine Corps and the military teaches you that is valued here in my current setting at Makani. And there's a couple of things. You also asked me about, you know, the framework of going and speaking to people that may not understand why we do what we do. You know, there are going to be different worldviews about, I saw this at Columbia for sure, too. There are folks that just believe war in any context is bad. Guns, no matter what, are bad. And I think I've worked really hard to understand those worldviews and to appreciate them. And when I do have conversations with folks about why I've chosen to serve, I actually use that same story about going to D.C. and seeing all of the bad things that happen in the world. And that formed the foundation of my worldview, which is that there are evil people in the world. And we're not perfect. What I was asked to do in Iraq, I have plenty of misgivings about. But I also think that by and large, if the United States was to step aside and relinquish its status as a world leader, somebody else, some other power, whether it's China or Russia or someone with any entity with intentions would have a less moral, a take on how to administer some sort of world order with less goodness, less malevolent, benevolence than the United States. So, you know, my worldview is centered around the idea that if the United States stepped aside, it would be a lot worse, and that I wanted to be a part of standing up to bad people, to evil things that were going on in the world. So, yes, the Marine Corps exists to break things, and I stayed in the reserves in large part because I sort of felt like, okay, so I've done my 12 years of active duty, and I'm going to step aside and pursue other things that are of interest to me, and I want to make the world a better place and in other ways, right? I feel like when I was in my 20s, it was the right place for me to contribute. But moving on, I felt like I could contribute in other ways. But I wanted to stay in the reserves in part because, you know, if World War III happened, I still wanted to have the opportunity to contribute. But I still wanted to be a part of that defense that might be needed. So, you know, all of that, I'll finish by saying that hanging up the spurs has been a really tough decision. I think, you know, I think it's just time. I think my ability to contribute in the ways that I want to in the Marine Corps has sort of run its course. But I because of my drive to contribute and to be relevant, it's also been really difficult. But I guess that kind of goes back to your previous point about, you know, can I keep doing all of it? And at the end of the day, my contributions to the Marine Corps side were becoming less and less relevant. And so I prioritized, you know, spending time on other things some of the list that I went through before, because, you know, because the Marine Corps time was less meaningful.
And I feel like this is therapy in public, either that, or you have like personally like gone in and pulled out components of my personal narrative and just put them directly on top of yourself. I feel so much the same way about, you know, if North Korea really becomes bellicose and we send a bunch of Marines over there, like we did in 1950, how would I feel if everybody else was going down range and I'm just sitting back here in a really comfortable life in a really comfortable country and not doing my bit to try and say, hey, let's protect the citizens of Seoul. So I completely relate to what you're saying, but I hear, like, physically, I hear when you speak there, you having to, I think what I heard was you framing things as a Marine and then trying to frame them in a way that the general public or probably the Googler audience who's going to be listening to this podcast would understand when I asked you about, well, the different worldview components, like that there actually is evil in the world and stuff. And that physically, I don't know if you noticed it, but I'm not going to edit it out at the end because I think it's instructive. That mental recalibration to talk to different people and to find that piece of common ground with them is difficult to do. And you touched on it a little bit earlier in the veteran transition component. I wonder, to again pull into something that you said a bit earlier, which touches on the overall portion of this project that I'm trying to undertake here in this podcast. How effective do you think that any one person can be at breaking down those completely different worldviews that we run into? Is the best that we can do trying to frame our own lives in a way that other people understand? Or do you think, based on your experience, that you actually can reach in and convince people to view the military as something other than an institution solely related to destruction with a bunch of bloodthirsty psychopaths in it, for instance? Or, you know, on the flip side, as I'm about to travel back to the Midwest, something that most Googlers or lots of people on the quote best coast will refer to as the flyover states where I grew up, they'll look at, you know, our company and say, oh, well, you're just a bunch of hippie liberals who clearly have no idea what it is to really work. And I don't really understand what you do and you haven't added any value to my life, right? You are personally sitting at the axis to both of those questions. And all, I guess, the question I'm trying to ask you is, when you back up and reflect, do you think that you have been able to personally touch other people's worldviews and bring them closer together? Or are you more pessimistic about the current state of dialogue in America that those worldviews are just kind of hardened and there's no way to bring them together?
No, I'm optimistic. I just think it's a lot harder than we want it to be. And so let me unpack that a little bit. I think, so I've got a couple of experiences to draw from. One is that at Columbia, we were going through a period where the university was trying to figure out whether they were going to bring ROTC back to campus. So originally, well, let's say 70 years ago, Columbia University produced a lot of military veterans, had a lot of veterans on campus during World War II. There was a lot of military presence, and President Eisenhower was the president of Columbia University for a period of time. So there's a military history there. But during the Vietnam War, like many of the Ivy Leagues, the RTC was kicked off campus as institutions such as Columbia divorced themselves from the military. And the university in 2010 and 2011 was sort of going through a catharsis and sort of trying to repair that relationship institution to institution. And that was difficult for a lot of folks because, you know, undergraduate students that are just trying to find their way in the world and trying to understand what their worldview is, graduate students, professors had some really, really difficult conversations during that time. And that really uncovered, you know, worldview is the term that keeps coming back to mind. It was just sort of, is the military inherently evil because it exists, or does it serve a purpose because there's evil out there and the military is there to be a bulwark between that evil and the folks here at home? And that was a really hard debate. There were a bunch of public conversations that basically went nowhere. It was just people screaming at each other. And there was one student group that decided to host a more intimate, sort of meaningful interaction where, among other things, we just sort of tried to role play. And I mean, this gets a little bit touchy-feely here, but we tried to role play each other in a scenario. And after that, you know, it was only a couple of hours, but after that couple of hours, we understood each other so much better that, you know, I learned a ton from that interaction and made some friends that I really, really valued. So that's one interaction. I think you bring that to the present day where we're, you know, sort of shouting past each other on social media. You know, I think, like you, have some, you know, some people are worried today that our Facebook feeds are bubbles. My Facebook feed is not a bubble by any stretch of the imagination. I have, you know, I grew up in Southern California, but my mom's side of the family was ultra liberal and Jewish from Chicago, and my dad's side of the family was ultra Christian from the heart of Indiana. And so we'd go on these family trips when I was a kid. We'd land in Chicago and I'd get blasted from the left on how great Paul Tsongas was. And I'd go, you know, 4 hours, not even that, like 2.5 hours into Indiana, where, you know, my family and my dad's side of the family go to church 4 times a week, and it would be Jerry Falwell and all the, so I heard both sides, and I ended up in a, I think, a fairly good position to understand a bit about both sides. But my Facebook feed now is both of those sides of the family, plus the military. I made a lot of friends, you know, Marines that I served with, Marines that I led that have, you know, grew up in Iowa and Nebraska, and as you said, the flyover states, and just, you know, they just have a different starting point for their reality. And I have made zero progress having conversations on Facebook. I've had zero progress trying to interact with people at a surface level, but I've had some really meaningful conversations with folks where, you know, I went out to a beer with a buddy of mine from the Marine Corps who is, as you know, one of those people I just described, from, you know, middle America, grew up in a red state, listens to, you know, conservative radio and Fox News. And I have, my starting point, I say that as that he's the other side, but really I feel like I start kind of in the middle. Like I try to listen to NPR and I read Reuters and I try not to be on one side or the other of these very, you know, divisive issues. And we found a ton of common ground, but it took, you know, going out and having a beer and really having a, you know, an in-depth conversation. And I learned some from him. I hope he learned some from me. I was able, and I think that for me, the key takeaway is if it's a meaningful conversation, I'm also taking from it. I'm not just there to educate somebody. That's almost a silly way to think about bridging a divide, right? There should be a give and take, and therefore I need to be open and learning, right? So anyway, but the bottom line is that I'm optimistic. I think optimistic if we spend the time to really, really talk to each other, and that we can't expect to be able to solve big, hairy, you know, worldview kind of problems if, you know, we're in a 144 characters or something like it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/htwmib. That's bit.ly/htwmib. What I hear in there, and tell me if this is wrong, but what I hear in there is you need you feel like you need to personally exemplify the change that you want to bring forward. You have to be willing to actually really consider somebody else's worldview, allow that to change you, put yourself in their shoes. And from that point of vulnerability, then we can actually mesh together. And that is a time consuming and difficult thing to do, all of which personally, if that is what you're saying, I agree with. And I struggle even in this medium trying to get people to tell a interesting story about themselves in a way that other people can empathize with. Is there any way, I mean, often at Google, we think about scalability, and I realize this runs completely contrary to what you just said. Like it's difficult to do this, but it's something that's at the top of my mind because I worry about the health of the polity in America. I worry about the inability of my family to have a conversation about politics over Thanksgiving because it just devolves into a shouting match. And like, we literally have to just not discuss it at all. And that's not a great spot to be in as a country. It's certainly not a great spot to be in as a family. I wonder if you think that there's any way that we can scale that type of empathy, that type of civil dialogue, that type of real understanding to try and kind of bring these worldviews together. Maybe there isn't. I just would love to know if you think there is.
I think it's systemic. I don't have an elixir here, but what I've been thinking about a lot lately and trying to get to the bottom of is sort of how we got to where we are. And I made a reference before to Fox News. If I can say for the record, I think CNN is basically just as bad. MSNBC is definitely just as bad. There are a ton of, you know, Mother Jones and, you know, InfoWars are equally bad on opposite sides of the spectrum. And, you know, because I work where I work, and I don't, not just Google, I just mean Silicon Valley, which, you know, part of what attracted me to this place is that we were changing the world, right? The iPhone changed domestic and international politics because of the access to information that it created. I'm sorry, I meant to say Facebook changed domestic and international politics. You know, it led to the Arab Spring. It also had a tremendous impact on the presidential election in 2008 and 2012 and again in 2016. So these are, I think, fairly monumental shifts in how people consume information. That said, you know, the bifurcation or trifurcation or more has come from, it started before the advent of social media. So when I start these sort of more meaningful conversations, one of the places I try to go is just acknowledge from the start that, you know, we may not be operating the same baseline set of facts because maybe I'm getting my information from a different source. Not that I'm getting it from farther left or farther right than you prefer, but just different, right? And that if I'm reading Reuters and you're listening to NPR, maybe we just heard a story a little bit differently. And I think acknowledging that, whether it's with my much more conservative family in Indiana, whom I love to death, or my liberal family in Chicago, or my Marine friends, or whoever, I think if we can, as a society, work towards a place where we acknowledge that the sources of our information matter a lot, and that we are Americans, we are in this together, and the job of those organizations are to create an us versus them kind of scenario, that we can start from there to then try to break down into a conversation that is meaningful and finds common ground on the rest of it. Your question about scalability, to me, comes back to that systemic structural question. And so on the one hand, what I'm using is like in an individual conversation, if we can get to a place where we can acknowledge that, you know, that sort of common starting point of information. And I've done that several times in my experience. That's the place to start a good conversation. That's what leads me to believe that the sources of information are the place to go. And then from there, you know, how do you do that? How do you change that at scale? Well, I think then you've got to break it down pretty methodically. Where are the incentives, whether they're financial or otherwise, maybe political in terms of influence or some other kind of incentive? And then, you know, try to have an impact on those incentives. And that, you know, I don't have all the answers to those things. I'm still very much in exploration on that front. I think where I've gotten to now is that it's the information sources that are the sort of root of the divisions. And that, you know, we're just, I start a conversation sometimes with Marines that I went to war with, that I love to my core, and we just start from a very different reality. Just a different, we live on different planets quite well, I mean, figuratively, obviously, but it just feels like we're just on different planets, and we can't have a conversation at all. And to your point, you can't have a conversation at your family dinner because you're just, there's the other side seems so irrational. How could you say something so irrational? And the reason they're not irrational, they're not dumb. They're good people. They start with a different set of information, a different set of facts. And if you were given those same set of facts, you'd probably come to the same conclusions that they did. That'd be my guess. But anyway, I think you got to go back to the.
I agree. It's incredibly difficult to do. And I personally don't know the way forward on that either. And I would love to just back up a little bit more into the dilemma, maybe the trilemma that a lot of us face, which is a bit more personal, but between your family and your work and the things that you're called to do. And you already talked about it a bit around not feeling like you're doing anything well, but one thread that I'd love to pull on there that I think is underappreciated is that you either have to have incredible reservoirs of internal strength to feel like every day you're stepping out and you're, I know personally, most days I get up, I'm like, I didn't spend enough time with my daughter. I didn't spend enough time at work. I didn't spend enough time here. And I'm constantly failing. And either you're a glutton for punishment, which a lot of Marines are, just a bit sadistic, or you have some other place that you can go to get strength. And, you know, I know we're both married to beautiful, intelligent, awesome women. That helps. If you could just reflect for a second in a completely different vein about where you lean on for when you're feeling just totally out of gas and like you're not doing things well. I know that a lot of people who are really struggling to try and make the world better a bit in their own way often feel like they're just totally gassed. And for you personally, like, how do you re-energize? How do you keep taking the punches, even if they're you know, you beating yourself up and press on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll reference sort of my lowest point was my sort of fifth and final deployment. I was, you say, out of gas. I mean, I knew with every, you know, with all of my mental capacity that I was in Iraq to protect Marines and to do an important job. But at some level, I couldn't get myself to do anything. I could barely get out of bed. I didn't want to go fly. I didn't want to. And the thing that motivated me was just to look externally. I looked around at the Marines around me and just started to focus my effort on them. And I think I've used that same idea a lot in the last just couple of years when I do get that sense that, you know, I'm either failing a lot or that I'm not being effective. I think I just kind of start back with, you know, focusing my time and effort on those just sort of immediately around me. And now that's, what can I do for my wife? What can I do for my kids? What can I do for my close friends and, you know, my mom and dad or something like that? It's, you know, basically just focus outward. And what I find in that is that those little victories, the little, like, hey, I did something nice for somebody, kind of gives me a little bit of a boost. And, you know, I think, I don't remember if it's General McChrystal or somebody else wrote a book. And I've actually been doing this for a long time where I actually make my bed every morning, not because, and I don't do hospital corners and it's not like a military standard, but I make my bed in the morning because it's like it's a tiny little thing that I can do that makes me feel good. It's like, if I didn't do anything else well, I did that. And I think in a similar vein, when things are crappy at work or, you know, I'm otherwise not being effective, I think I just kind of bring it home. I just bring it back right close to what are the things that I can do. If I can make my son laugh or I can do something nice for my wife, then that's a starting point.
Two things I pull out of that: strength through giving and then strength through the tangible components of what you do. There's a slight tension based on what I know about X, between scalability, which you already talked about, and failure goals. And this is one thing I want to touch on before we wrap up here. But from what I've seen Astro Teller, who's the head of X, talk about, he talks about setting goals, like you want your kite to crash six times. Otherwise, you're not pushing it to its limits, right? You're not figuring out what the real performance envelope of this thing is. And you're living in a safe place where you're not learning. And it's only through failure that we learn. So working in StratOps in X, can you tell me, have you been able to kind of infuse that same ethos into the people who are around you? Undoubtedly, like, it's just a difficult thing cognitively for any human to try and go out and make themselves fail so that they can learn. And have you been able to bolster those individuals internally and get them to focus on the small victories that they can have every day? Or how do you make other people who are in an environment where they're similarly hard on themselves, where they similarly feel like not only are they failing all the time, but they should be failing all the time inside of X. How do you help them function more effectively? How do you bring that to others?
Yeah, it's difficult. It goes against so much of, you know, our culture and, you know, sort of people's pride and the rest of it. I do encourage my team to be transparent about what they don't do and don't do well, that we're moving at a pace where we're just going to have to accept that some things are not going to go well. And we're willing to accept that things aren't going to go well, because if we were super careful about everything we did, we'd just be moving at a pace that was unacceptable in the environment we're living in. It's right. We can't take 50 years to get this energy kite out into the marketplace. So let's take some risks. We have to do that. And, you know, my commitment to you as a manager is to, you know, when things don't go well because you are moving fast, you need to know that I'm going to back you up. You know, what I say to my team is, I will back you up all day long if you're well-intentioned and things don't go well because you were moving fast. I have no room for people who willfully cut corners. And I try to draw that distinction between mistakes that are done because you're moving fast or because you're trying to get things done quickly. And I'm going to be lazy and not really consider the consequences here, or I'm going to actually like willfully do something wrong, even though I know better. But it's really hard. I mean, I try to exemplify it. I admit mistakes all the time. I admit mistakes publicly in front of the entire team. I've also done, you know, in the squadron, we have this sort of age-old tradition of standing up in front of everybody that was a part of a flight and debriefing. And we debrief two or three things that go well, but we basically spend the entire debrief talking about what went wrong. And so I use that as an example, and I tell my team all the time, look, you do 1,000 things right every day. Probably not going to tell you of all those things that you do right. I'm probably going to give you critique on the few things that need to get done better. I do remind myself as a manager that, you know, I need to give some positive reinforcement also, but I think it's just a reality that we need to be comfortable that we're not going to be perfect, and that the strongest individuals are the ones that can truthfully acknowledge that they're not doing things perfectly. And again, go back to the squadron, the pilots that I respected the most were not the ones that got up in front of the squadron and tried to hide mistakes or tried to pretend like everything went well. The folks that I really respected were the ones that just laid it all out there. Those are the pilots that had the most street credibility, because, you know, they had the confidence to admit when things didn't go well. And so I've really tried to help the team embrace that. But I won't, you know, I'm not going to pretend like it's smooth sailing. I think everybody has their own tolerance for that, especially in a place where people are trying to get promoted and trying to look good in front of their boss and all of that. It's hard. But, you know, as managers, we can incentivize it by, you know, making examples of people that have, you know, done things and admitted mistakes and are still, you know, and survived to tell the tale and actually were rewarded because of it. And then, you know, most importantly, as I said before, just exemplifying it ourselves and admitting when we do things as managers that are imperfect, and, you know, we still live too. So,
look, I think that's, even internally, I don't know how other people view the inside of Google, but there's this old quote that my pastor occasionally says, where it's like, oh, why would I go to church? All Christians are it's full of hypocrites. And the rejoinder is always, no, there's room for plenty more, right? And and I feel like that sometimes inside of Google and inside of X, like the external version of what we preach is very difficult to do. And people don't appreciate that internally, we personally struggle with this. And then we have teams that we're leading that we struggle with. And I had these exact conversations that you're talking about just this week, trying to bring some of these things forward. It's not easy for us. Look, I'm keen to head into just a few rapid questions before we end, but I want to ask you just two things before I do. One is what others can do, in your opinion, to help. And that can be with any of the various missions that you were talking about, Big Brothers or families or civil dialogue or what have you. And the other thing is, what should I have asked you that I haven't?
Okay. Well, I think in terms of what people can do to help, I feel very strongly about starting locally. Our communities are so important. And that goes from, you know, if it's your street or your city block, or maybe your neighborhood. I think there's nothing that replaces the building of a really strong community. And let me plug a book that I read recently that has sort of resonated with me for, I don't guess, the last 6 months or so. And it is the book called Tribe by Sebastian Younger. You know, the theme of the book is essentially humans are social animals. And in years past, the community was sort of everything. If you look at Native American culture, the community, the tribe was everything. But in the United States now, it's not uncommon for you to not know your neighbor just across the street or right next to you. And you might be surprised here that after 9/11, the suicide rate and the mental health issues actually went down on the island of Manhattan. It's counterintuitive, but what happened is theorized in the book is that that event contributed to the people feeling a sense of community on Manhattan, you know, that the event of 9/11 brought people together. And that bringing of people together decreased mental health issues, depression, and suicide. And I think, you know, for me, it all starts with that. I'm convinced after reading that book and thinking about it for the last 6 months that, you know, if we can build solid communities and be a community, and that's really what it is you know, meeting your neighbors, doing a barbecue with your neighbors, thinking about what, you know, issues locally matter to you, you know, going to being vulnerable enough to go ask for a cup of sugar and starting a relationship with the people that you live near. I think that leads to a bunch of other goodness that's really, really important. And if you are so inclined to do something on the state or national level, I think that's great. You know, your community is so important, and I think it'll pay off for you and for those around you.
Now, and then the other question, yeah. What should I have asked you that I haven't gotten to yet? And if you just want to tell me that and then jump right into the answer, feel free.
I don't know. You've asked a lot of good questions, man. I don't have any. You know, there's a lot of. I mean, I think for the focus of the project, and I think the idea that, you know, we have this divide in the political discourse, I think to me is the most troubling I've come across. You know, certainly as an individual who wants to make the world a better place, I've been trying to figure out how to do that for a long time. But I think we're in a particularly tough moment. So I don't know what question you should ask me. I just want to say, you know, thank you for what you're doing. It's an effort, and it's a solid effort to try to help people understand each other. And I think that's the most important thing we can be working on right now.
Brilliant. Last thing, any books or talks or speeches or anything that you'd like to plug? I know you just talked about Tribe with Sebastian Younger. We'll put that in the show notes. Anything else that you're learning right now if people want to be more like Neil Rickner? how can they learn by learning the same things that you're learning from?
The other book I'll point to, I mean, this is what I'm thinking about and reading these days, is Hillbilly Elegy. Yeah. I don't know if you know that.
I just read that one. Really, really, also very relatable, given that, you know, he also became Marine. And yeah, very, very, very good. Helped me understand a lot, I think.
Yeah. So I would say for your listeners, if they're interested in that topic of political divisions, that is an incredible read, very timely. And, you know, he, yeah, I would, that's what I would plug.
Great. Awesome. With that, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks again for taking the time to talk with me this morning, this evening, your time, especially 3 weeks after your latest boy came out. Please give your wife an extra hug for me, because wow, she deserves it, being able to handle him for one extra minute. So thanks again, Neil. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/HDWMIB. That's bit.ly/HDWMIB. I could not do these without the dedicated professionals at Sound4U in South Africa. They are behind the music and the mix and everything else that goes into making this podcast actually happen. They go above and beyond in every way, turning a simple recording into a true production. Thanks again.